Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. We're going to get everything started. I think everyone in the room knows me, but if you don't, I'm Margot. I'm the Education and Community Engagement Director for the Rockford Symphony, and you are here for Soundbites to meet and hear from our music director finalist, Eric Garcia. We're having a great week with him, and as always, I know we'll have a wonderful conversation with him and Mark. So without further ado on that front, I will turn it over and let you all hear what you came for, and welcome Eric.
And as you probably have already guessed, Mark Baldwin here, causing anxiety and probably the heartbreak of psoriasis and violas since 1978. I'm here with our music director candidate, Eric Garcia. And as usual, I always like to start when doing an interview with, what's your story? Where do you come from? Where did it start?
Great question. So I'm originally from Temple, Texas, which is a town equally situated between... By the way, can you hear me okay? Okay, great. I wonder if we can get just a little bit more...
Actually, probably in that amp, I'm not sure we can, but can we get a little more gain? The end.
And testing there. 1, 2, 3.
Ah, there
okay.
We go.
Great. So about halfway between the mark of Waco, Texas and Austin, Texas on I-35. And now I currently live in Seattle, Washington with my wife, and it's just a joy to be here.
What turned you on to music as a kid? What made you want to play an instrument? And what instrument was that, by the way?
Yes. Well, I became obsessed with music around age 5. And I would listen to popular music of all kinds. My parents listened to all music popular. And I remember them having just an endless collection of LPs. This was the time of the MTV explosion, if you remember that, in the early 80s. And so I was about 5 years old then, so that shows my age a little. And I would sit for hours at a time just listening to rock music videos and watching them. And music became a passion. And it really didn't matter what style of music it was. I just enjoyed listening. And so I started banging on furniture with sticks, with wooden spoons. And my parents thought it might be a good idea to go ahead and buy him a snare drum. And they did. And I started taking snare drum lessons at age 5. And from there, I graduated to a drum set at age 7. And the rest is really history from there. I was a drummer full on from that point forward.
So were you doing, did you go into the drum corps end of things or just pretty much stay in big band and classical orchestral stuff?
That's a great question. I did not go into drum corps, and of course there's an amazingly rich tradition here in this area, as I know. But I did lots of marching band because, of course, I'm in Texas, and in Texas it's football, and anything to serve football is there. So that's marching band, of course. But I did play lots of jazz. I played in rock bands in high school. But all the while, I was, at this point already, a classical music devotee, 100%.
Where do you end up getting your degrees?
Yes, great question. My undergraduate degree was at the University of Texas at Austin, and it was a dual degree in composition and music theory. And then I went on to receive my master's and doctorate degree in orchestral conducting down the road at Northwestern University. So go Wildcats. If there are any Wildcats in here, go Wildcats.
Oh, that's an interesting progression, because most of the time, or at least it's expected, that most conductors come up either being a piano player or a string player. And generally, they don't come from the percussion ranks too much, except if you believe the old joke about the guy who...
Do you want to tell it?
I can't tell it all that. I can't tell all that well, but I got to remember, I still have to play a concert under him. But you know, it's the old joke. They gave him a horn, and he couldn't play the horn, so they put him in the percussion section. They gave him two sticks, and he couldn't play percussion, so they took one stick away and made him a conductor. Viola, or yeah, you want to go through the viola section, you can do it that way too. Exactly.
Now, but I must be utterly transparent. That is a very good point. I get asked this quite a bit. When I was, and I will never forget this because I think about this all the time when I meet young musicians. When I was in the fifth grade, that's when they would start people on string instruments. And I was so excited because here I was, a drummer and now a concert percussionist, and I was listening to lots of classical music, and now I can finally play a string instrument. Great. So they look at my hands and they think, you're perfect for viola. And I say, wonderful. Unfortunately, you can't play in the orchestra and the band at the same time. And so I had to make a decision. And so as a result, I ended up buying a string instrument, a viola, for myself, self-taught at home, and stuck with that for a little while. But I always think back to that when you are that age and you're told you can't do something, you do it. You just say, well, I'm going to find a way. And so I did. Now, I did take piano lessons. With all full transparency, I did take piano lessons growing up. I don't play in public, but I do study my scores at the piano. It's the best way to read all of these different parts and conceptualize them, is to sit at the piano and play through them. And can I give one last plug for percussionists?
This is your show.
I have to say this for anyone keeping count on percussionists that are conductors. Sir Simon Rattle, former music director of the Berlin Philharmonic, was a percussionist. And often considered the greatest conductor of all time by most conductors, Carlos Kleiber, a percussionist. So just a little percussion pride I have to throw out.
There you go.
And piano is often considered a percussion instrument. So thank you so much.
Yeah.
I appreciate the support.
So when did Northwestern? Where did your career as a conductor start?
Yes, well, it was at Northwestern, and actually a little bit before Northwestern, that I really started to look at the conducting world in two different ways. I looked at it as, well, you either go the academic route, or you go the professional route. And when you're younger, you see them as either this path or this path. Now, of course, now that I'm older and I've done both, they're not mutually exclusive. They are the same conducting world. You're just taking a slightly different venture. And you can do both, and I have done both. But it was during my time in my undergraduate, right before Northwestern, that I felt like academia was where I wanted to be. I wanted to work with young musicians who were playing Mahler for the first time, who were playing Brahms Symphony No. 4 for the first time, and what it must be like to discover those notes for the first time with other musicians. The thought of working with young conductors and teaching them all of the things that I did not know at that age, or that people did not want to share with me, just seems so exciting. I wanted to give back everything that people had given to me or I felt like I hadn't learned. And so right out of Northwestern University, I went to the University of Evansville in Evansville, Indiana, just maybe 5 hours from here, not far, and was the director of orchestral activities there. And what's interesting is after that, my career has really been, I think, this for me, this ideal balance of living these two dreams of academia and the professional world. After University of Evansville, there was a job opening for the assistant conductor of the Seattle Symphony. And at this point, I had studied at the Aspen Music Festival. I had worked with a lot of great professional musicians. And there was something in me that thought, I really want to be part of this professional world. I want to stand in front of a great orchestra like the Seattle Symphony. So this was my first audition with a professional orchestra. And so 20 other conductors and I were there lined up, ready to go. They send you out on stage in front of the Seattle Symphony, and they are exhausted at this point in the day. And you conduct through your repertoire, and we hit it off. Things went very well that day, and they offered me the position, and I moved across the country to Seattle, Washington, and became assistant conductor with the Seattle Symphony. And that forever changed my life. And so from that point forward, it's been just a matter of fulfilling that love of academia and also being involved in the professional world as equally as I can be. But they're just such strong passions, and they're so different, but at the end of the day, it's the same music.
Now, was Gerard Schwartz there when you were there?
Yes, I happened to get there at, one would say, the ideal time for a young conductor. It was the final season of Maestro Gerard Schwartz, who's one of my dear friends and mentors, and the first season and second season of Ludovic Morlot, who would be their music director for the next 9 seasons. So I got to see this great divide between someone who had been there for almost 30 seasons and built a concert hall to a younger music director who was taking their first music director position and feeling out a tradition which was already kind of laid there. So that was, I couldn't have asked for a better seat in the house to really watch that transition and to see how each music director interacted with the orchestra. It's incredibly educational.
Well, sometime in the next day or two, if I have a moment, I want to ask you about Gerard Schwartz, because he's one of my trumpet heroes. He is one of fabulous
virtuoso.
Now, as an assistant conductor, what were your roles there? What were your duties there?
Yes, as assistant conductor, of course, your principal role is to be there at the drop of a hat to jump on stage and conduct a rehearsal or performance. And so your tails are in your office. They're always ready to go. How often are they used? Probably not very often. As a matter of fact, when I arrived, a librarian sidled up to me and said, "Eric, I don't want you to get too excited. Gerry Schwartz has never missed a concert in 26 seasons." And he didn't for that final season. But I did have to jump in a few times throughout my time there and run rehearsals, or at the end of the week, run performances. And so you have to be there marking your score, learning the interpretation of that conductor on stage. Not your interpretation, but you are giving yourself to what they want, because you want the orchestra to have that smooth transition should something happen. Also, of course, you are there for education. You are there to conduct all of the education concerts and to meet with educators throughout the community and to get to know them, to go work with their orchestras, and also to do lots of community interactions at dinners, at lunches, just to really talk about the symphony orchestra. At this point, music directors are quite busy, and so they will send you out as a proxy in a way. And as a young conductor, I really couldn't have asked for anything better.
How long were you there at Seattle?
So in Seattle for 2 seasons officially as assistant conductor, and then another season there just coming in and guesting when possible.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a couple of wonky questions just because I'm curious. What did you see between Gerard Schwartz and the next music director, looking on as the assistant, having worked with one, what were the differences? What did you see that they wanted to do differently?
Well, that's, you know, in a lot of ways, Gerard Schwartz, he knew he was on his final season. He was stepping down. It had been announced already. So he had his bucket list of compositions that he was conducting. In a way, he had built this orchestra into a national treasure. With a vast recording catalog. He had been there to build Ben Arroyo Hall, the gorgeous hall in downtown Seattle. And so for him, it was really just a matter of the orchestra knew him, he knew the orchestra, mm-hmm. He knew how to say so little and get so much. Now, when you are a younger music director like Ludovic Morlot and you're coming in, having really been educated in London and in Paris, you're coming in with a different kind of technique, different style. And he came in with lots of ideas about how to broaden repertoire into the French repertoire, into much more Eurocentric repertoire, really just to expand, to get more involved in commissioning composers that perhaps had not ever been heard in Seattle before. So I think to that extent, it was really their aesthetic, their preferences for repertoire more than anything else.
How did you find them observing as an assistant conductor and learning? How did you assess their difference in technique?
Oh, sure. Well, every conductor is different when it comes to technique. And it doesn't matter if you study under the same teacher. We're all very different because every body is different and it moves differently. And so it has to be a natural extension of how we move and shape our body. But I could get very technical, but that's you know, I don't know. I think I can say this. George Schwartz is quite imposing. He's a tall gentleman, and he's just quite imposing. Ludovic Morlo is around 5'6" and so the podium they raised just a little. He requested, and he is just very energetic and excited. He's a spark plug, and he just wants to go. And so when he walks out on stage, you feel the energy. Boom! The door opens, and he comes out moving. He doesn't come out with this walk. He comes out ready to go. He gets on the podium, and then everything starts to happen. Yeah.
Where did you go after Seattle?
So after Seattle, I was director of orchestral activities at the Greenwood School of Music at Oklahoma State University, where I conducted the orchestras, and I conducted or directed the graduate conducting program. And then I went on to Oklahoma City University at the Bass School of Music, and I was director of orchestral activities there, and I directed the graduate conducting program. So in so many ways, it was, while continuing to cover conduct with orchestras around the country, including the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and it was just a joy, like I said, to be able to work with students and take this professional knowledge and bring it and change how everything had been done in these programs. And when working with my graduate student conductors who were 22, 23, 24 years old and on the cusp of, you know, making a career, to try to give them every bit of knowledge that I hadn't had in my pocket. And to me, I couldn't tell them enough. I really couldn't give them enough information because I think back to what it was like as a young conductor. And you're searching, you're forever searching for answers. And some people are a little, not stingy, but they want to keep them as their secrets. I don't. I want to let every young conductor that I cross paths with know, I recommend this, I don't recommend this. And I give them a long list. And by the time they're done studying with me, I say, now this might not work for you, but I highly recommend it. And this will give you a much happier life and hopefully a more fruitful life in the music world. In Oklahoma, I also was artistic director of the Oklahoma Youth Orchestras, which was this robust youth orchestra program that had close to 400 students under its umbrella. So as artistic director of that, I conducted the top orchestra, which was about 70 students, just incredible level orchestra. But I was able to oversee our other ensembles, percussion ensemble, wind ensemble, other orchestras, down to elementary school level orchestras, and just to work with them and encourage them to keep going up the kind of musical ladder.
As a conducting instructor, again, this is just kind of a question for me. What, obviously, you're there to help the conductors get better at expressing their musical ideas to an orchestra in a way that the orchestra can understand.
Yes.
How does that affect, if any, your own conducting in working with the students?
Yes. Oh, it does. It does indeed. This summer, as a matter of fact, I was at the Eastern Music Festival in Greensboro, North Carolina. I was guest conducting, and I was also working with 9 young conductors as part of their conducting institute. And this conducting institute is quite prestigious in this country, and these conductors are ready to go. They are hungry, they're excited, they are ready to take over the world. And so they come with a lot of knowledge, with a lot of experience, but they are still in their early stages. So there is a lot to tell them. And so when you can get that specific, because they're at that level, you can really get into the nitty-gritty of why, where are you staring right now? And why aren't you looking at your orchestra? And why are you staring at this one player when they've already put down their instrument and you should be looking over here? And do you think that prep beat is really going to elicit the sound that you want? Because I feel like you are searching for something else. What you find is these conductors later in the day will come to your rehearsal while you're working on a piece. And they stand there and they're looking and they're taking notes, and they have your score. They have a copy of the score you're conducting. And any conductor worth their salt will start to really think about what they're doing, as you should. We're students until we leave this beautiful earth. We're always learning. We don't know it all. We never will. And so I think it's a great symbiotic relationship that we have with our students, because I might say something to a student in the morning that in the afternoon will help me to an endless degree. And that happened this summer. I thought, well, my goodness, I told him to do this. Why am I not doing that? And I think, honestly, the moment you start ignoring that is you're missing opportunities. Don't miss opportunities.
It reminds me of a story. I probably told it before, but it's when Andre Previn was taking lessons from Pierre Monteau in London, I believe. And this story is from Andre Previn. He says he got up in his session and conducted, and Pierre Monteau came up and he said, "Ah, I see you went to see Mr. Bernstein last night." "It's all very well and good to conduct to the ladies in the front row, but first make sure the French horns come in correctly." And that's probably somewhat altered, but basically that's the gist of it. You are a music director in Boise. And how did that come about? How long have you been there? And this is going to be a long-ended question. What have you done there? What have you developed there in Boise?
Yes. Well, I was, before Boise, I was at Oklahoma City University at the Bass School of Music and overseeing this amazing youth orchestra. And this position opened up in Boise. And, of course, at this point, their reputation was growing and growing and growing, the orchestra's reputation. And so I was very excited. Something just really struck me about this possibility. And so it was another one of these moments where I really had to use my gut of, well, should I apply? Is this something that I think would be a good fit for me? Because if I don't think it's going to be a good fit for me, if I don't think it's going to be a good fit for the orchestra, then I won't bother with it, because another conductor should do this. And I thought long and hard about it, and it seemed like, just like Seattle did years before, the right thing to do. And so I applied, and they invited me to audition. And I went in for a week and had a week with them, performing Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev and Shostakovich, and just getting to know the community and getting to know the orchestra. And we hit it off. We hit it off quite well. And I remember just making that decision that if they should invite me to be their music director, of course, I can only accept. I can only accept. There was no two ways about it. And they did. They did. It so worked out. And so, apart from being flattered, you start to make a game plan. Now, you have a game plan in order before you even go visit, because you research a community, you research an orchestra, you think about, am I a good fit for this orchestra in this community? And so, of course, I did that with Boise. But now that you are taking over as music director, now you really get to work with the staff. You really get to work with the board. And there's so many things that I wanted to see happen. that I felt like weren't happening and needed to, and were very simple to do, but would have really great results. And a few of these right off the bat were just having more of a presence in terms of social media. Now, that sounds like a no-brainer in so many ways in the time that we live in, but what I was noticing was this lack of, well, I want to see the music director talking about concerts. I want to see the music director interviewing musicians about upcoming concerts. I want to see musicians talking about upcoming concerts. I just want to hear more from the orchestra and the conductor. Because it's one thing for us to put together a great marketing. We have a card. We have a nice commercial. You hear a voiceover. You see pictures. It's exciting. But isn't it so much better when you get that personal connection, that personal voice from either the music director or the musicians? They can give you insights into what you're going to hear that weekend. And so for me, that's something that I thought, well, I can work this out with my marketing in no time. And sure enough, that's what we did. And I thought, well, for our community concerts, can we really explore different parts of the city that maybe have been, you know, for some reason off the map? And maybe there are parts of the city where we can entice people that have never come to our concert hall. And so I started to put together a community series that allowed for us to take musicians out to various parts of the city. And these are things which are so very important now for growing audiences, especially post-pandemic. And this was, you know, far before pandemic, but especially now post-pandemic, is we have to get out of the concert hall. And we have to get into the community more and more.
Well, that gives us kind of an insight of what you're looking at here in Rockford. Mm-hmm. But let me, as you said, and one can tell, you do your research. Mm-hmm. What brings you to Rockford? What is it about the Rockford and the Rockford Symphony that made you interested in the job?
Yes. Well, of course, Rockford Symphony Orchestra and having been here this week and having three rehearsals with the orchestra is an absolutely amazing orchestra. It's an orchestra that, first of all, wants to perform great music and perform it at the highest level. It's an orchestra that, and this is so very important, that wants to perform with one another. They enjoy playing with one another. It has a communal feeling. It has a familial feeling. And that is absolutely vital to be a great orchestra, is to really like one another, to like who you're playing with. And when I was at Northwestern University, I had many friends and colleagues who would play in the Rockford Symphony Orchestra. And so I would hear nothing but the greatest things about their time in Rockford. And just watching over time, the artistic growth, the commitment to new composers, just the expanding series that the Rockford Symphony has, certainly commitment to, and things that I just talked about, to the community, to performing more in the community, to education, and the fact that we have this great youth orchestra, and that we have a chamber orchestra within the youth orchestra, and over the next season, getting the brass choir out, and things that we've learned via the pandemic, that chamber music is such a great way to teach young musicians to perform. There were so many great things about the Rockford Symphony Orchestra on an artistic, communal, and educational level, which attracted me. And then I have to say, I would be remiss if I just did not say this, that as a seven-year resident of Chicagoland, when I lived in Illinois, this became my second home. And some of you have heard this many times, and I'm saying it again because it's true. It became my second home, really, and when I think of years, because apart from my hometown, I lived in this state and and worked in this vast state for the longest period of my life. And during those formative years, that makes quite an impression on you. During those years of 21 to, well, add 7 to that. Oy, vey.
Let's not do that.
But it makes an impression on you, and it does become your home in a way. And so many things about this made me want to be here and meet the orchestra and have a chance to play with this orchestra and meet the community. And then, of course, as we all know, this process had to go on pause during the pandemic. Well, I got to see what you were doing during the pandemic, what the Rockford Symphony was doing during the pandemic, just like we were all trying to do. And I was watching all of your concerts from Boise, Idaho. I would sit in my living room with my wife and our two dogs, and I would watch your concerts from the Art Museum, holiday concerts, and just watching Michelle, who I did not know yet, solo. And it was beautiful, and it was very inspiring to know, well, I don't know if this search is going to continue. I don't know if I'll be part of the search if it does continue. I don't know. Nevertheless, I'm invested now in what they're doing. I think it's really beautiful. And so when we were able to pick up our conversations again, I was just so grateful, and I said, absolutely, yes, I must be there, and we'll see what happens.
As music director, how do you see the music director's role in the community as, you know, the face of the Rockford Symphony? And also, we all talk about all the concerts we want to do, all the things we'd love to do, and the ugly truth is all of that boils down to money in a lot of ways, and fundraising, and being able to come up with pay structures that encourage the same people to come back and make a commitment to a particular orchestra. How do you see your role in that, realizing that's a very big question?
Well, no, it's the question in so many ways, especially the latter part of it. But as music director, you are the face, you are the voice of the symphony orchestra. So you are, to the greatest extent possible, interacting with the community. That means you are, as much as possible, through lunch, through coffee, just simply meeting, going for walks, meeting with donors, meeting with sponsors, meeting with your patrons. And meeting sounds so impersonal, but just getting together with them. And sometimes you are talking only about what's happening at the symphony orchestra. Sometimes you're talking about their golf game that day, or what they did with their children that weekend, or what you did this weekend. What you're doing is you're just, all of your patrons, your sponsors, your donors, they're part of the family. We're all part of this large Rockford Symphony Orchestra family. And as music director, it is your responsibility to ensure that you're just staying in touch, that you are continuing to just nurture these relationships, that they're getting from you what they want, and that you're listening to what they have to say. Are they happy with how things are going? Would they like to see things differently? What are their ideas? You can't get enough input as music director. You can't utilize all of it, of course, but you do want to hear it. And so it's really just to be available as much as possible for everyone in the community. When new communities move into town and your staff has done incredible work, or maybe a board member tells you, you know, they were huge supporters of the symphony orchestra in their hometown. Oh, that's fantastic. And so you meet them, and I guarantee they're going to want to know what's so great about the Rockford Symphony Orchestra and why they might want to come to this reception and meet board members. And maybe they're going to want to join the board. Who knows? Or be part of a committee. There's so many opportunities, but you're really inviting them into the community in a way and saying, listen, what we have here is truly special, and we think you're really going to love it and be part of it. And the last thing I'll say about that is that goes as well for new businesses in town. Anytime a new business comes into town, we must believe that there's something so special about what we're doing that any new business, any new organization would find it worthwhile to be associated with us in some way, to be supportive of us, because we are such a great cultural institution and so vital to the fabric of our community. And so as long as we make those connections happen, then we're really doing the very least as music directors.
Let's talk a little bit about music and working with an orchestra. Where's your programming interest lie? Now, we talked a little bit about this in past meetings, and I want to keep it fairly general because I also want to leave some time for some questions. And there are a lot more things I could ask you that I'm interested in, but how do you go about programming for an orchestra of our size, or the number of concerts? I mean, when you only have six classics concerts, you know, how do you figure out, okay, we got to play a few of the burger biggies to get the rear ends in the seats, you know?
What were the biggies? What was the word before that?
The burger biggies.
Okay.
Yes. You get okay. The burger biggies, you know, Beethoven 5, you know, pictures, you know.
Yes.
But how do you personally see programming that with new things, not, you know, the bleep and blop school, if you will, not too much of that. I'm not saying that one shouldn't hear that every now and again. Don't get me wrong. One should always listen.
Does everyone know what the bleep and blop school is?
Yeah. The bleep and blop school? Oh, what would I call that? Well, for me, 12-tone. You know, hardcore 12-tone music.
Yeah.
It's not my aleatoric music.
So the music might sound a bit like beep, brop, beep, brop, brop, beep, brop.
Yeah. And again, one's own taste, you know. But one should be exposed. And I think part of the mission of any orchestra is to expose new music, not only to expose new conductors, but to expose audiences to some different things. With six concerts, how do you go about addressing that?
Yes, it's one of the most, it's maybe the greatest honor that we have every season to think about future seasons, but it's also the most strenuous part of our position as music directors is doing just that. Because you have six, let's say, classics concerts, let's talk about those, and we have so much repertoire, and we have, of course, so many different wants and desires of the public to think about. So what I typically do is I have three different graphs that I look at. And the first one is, what does the audience want to hear? And this means, what do I know for a fact that audience members have said, we haven't heard this, we want to hear this, they've submitted it, I know exactly what you want. I have a good idea. So I make a long, long list. And then that, for me now, includes what would it be great for the community to hear? Maybe they're not asking for it, but it would be really wonderful for them to hear this long-lost symphony of Sibelius that we never get to hear. The next one is musicians. What do they want to perform? Because every musician on stage, they have their list every year. They tell you what they want to hear. And so I make a long list of that. What would it be great for our orchestra at their point in their constant evolution as an artistic ensemble to perform? And then this final list, and it's a sad list over here, is what is my bucket list? What are the pieces that I am just dying to conduct? And that list is long. But I keep that over here, and I rarely dip into it. Very rarely dip into it, because I don't really want to put myself too much in the equation. But I have to be very conscious of it, because if you don't love a piece with all your heart, it's very hard to translate it to the orchestra and then to the audience. And so I really, it's a matter of shuffling and putting together programs, thinking of different themes. Will this concert have a theme? Maybe not. Maybe it's built around one piece and the second half is more of an appetizer, but not necessarily related to the second half. Maybe all of these pieces are more connected by how they complement each other in color and sound, but not necessarily in historical context. So many different ways of looking at it. All the while, I am doing something very technical. I'm checking the services of musicians. For instance, piccolo, contrabassoon, tuba, harp, keyboard, percussion. So all of these instruments that you see on stage, of course, principal oboe, second oboe, bassoons, trumpets, trombones, will always be, they'll be getting their fill. But you have to look at these other instruments and make sure, are we utilizing these instruments enough for them to justify their time? Are they meeting their numbers as necessitated per their contract? So you really do have to think in technical terms like that. But then also, I have to be in touch with my librarian all the while about rentals. How much are these rentals? What are the rights for acquiring this piece? Are we going to be able to record this? And all of these things, because sure, it can be the most beautiful season I can conceive, but financially, if it's impossible, then it's a no-go. So I put together my season, and I've done quite a lot of legwork on it in terms of thinking about finances, service counts, and then at the very top, the artistic merit of this season. And then it goes through the filters of my incredible staff and artistic leadership team. And they come back with, well, we might need to move this piece, or we might need to change this piece. It's too much money. It's going to require too many musicians. No Alpine Symphony this season.
You knew that was on my bucket list, didn't you?
So maybe not a Strauss festival, maybe not all nine Mahler symphonies over the next 2 years. But nevertheless, it really is a matter of all of those pieces of the puzzle coming together. And what can I say? The Rockford Symphony did a perfect job of it this season. When I think about what my colleagues are doing this season, it's really a beautiful season.
So just as an aside, three pieces on your bucket list.
Yes. Well, a couple of these I said the other day. So Jean Sibelius, Symphony No. 7. Of course, we know his fifth. We know his second very well. His seventh symphony is his final symphony. At this point, Sibelius was growing to find composing just more painful than not. He suffered from crippling self-doubt and depression. And although he was lauded for, you know, over 50% of the world, so much of the world deemed him the next Beethoven, he had so much self-doubt in what he was doing. He was viewed as too conventional, old-fashioned. And so he would really struggle to compose. As music began to get bigger and bigger and orchestras got bigger and bigger, his music got smaller and smaller and smaller. So the Seventh Symphony is a 19-minute, one-movement symphony, about the size of a Beethoven orchestra. And this is when Mahler was writing for full chorus and enlarged orchestras, offstage musicians. And you can feel Sibelius starting to compress and compress. And at the end of 19 minutes, he said everything he wanted to say. There was this eighth symphony that everyone was waiting for, and he kept putting it off. Next season, next season, next season. And I think he knew it would never happen. And so for me, the seventh symphony stands as a true goodbye. He lived for another few decades, but he didn't compose. And so for me, the symphony to me is one of the most heartbreaking and just wonderful journeys of a composer coming to the end of their compositional life. Roy Harris, Symphony No. 3, great, very It's a la John Steinbeck. It's of that Americana period of it's a great American symphony that sometimes has it's kind of gotten lost after the 60s and the 50s. It's very tonal. It's very Midwest. He was a composer that was born in Oklahoma, and it has a very, you can just feel the soil and smell the soil when you hear this music. There's something so utterly American about it. It's very different than Copland, but it's wide open and spacious, and it's a piece that I've never conducted, and so it's sitting there. And you asked for a third, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I have to say that this is very interesting. This is very interesting. That when I think about all of the great symphonies that are in our repertoire, the one that I haven't conducted that I love for musical and historical reasons is Shostakovich Symphony No. 4. And it's the symphony that was the turning point in his career. This is the symphony that Shostakovich composed that right before, as he was composing this, Joseph Stalin put out an article in the Pravda condemning Shostakovich's music. So this is when composers were starting to be silenced by people like Joseph Stalin. It's hard to imagine that now. And so he was rehearsing this fourth symphony, and the first or second rehearsal, these gentlemen came in rehearsal, and they sat there. They were from the composer's union. And so they went backstage during the break, and later Shostakovich said, "I'm pulling the symphony." And that was that. And so it didn't get performed until after Stalin's death. It's a piece that is an incredibly heartbreaking time capsule of what it was like to be an artist trying to express themselves during one of the most difficult times the world has ever known. Yeah.
Okay, we're running out of time rapidly.
I'm so sorry.
No, not at all. I have more questions, but we don't have time. Any questions from you that you'd like to ask Eric? Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Which was going to be one of my next questions is what your interpretation of Brahms 4 and the other we didn't have time to get to a few comments about what we are playing in the concert tomorrow, but what can we look forward to in your Brahms 4?
Well, I think with Brahms 4 there's a blessing and a curse, because the blessing is every orchestra has performed it thousands of times, so in a lot of ways it can just play, but Johannes Brahms was such an overly detailed composer, and this goes along with his personality. I wish we had more time to talk about him as a person right now, but he imparted so many details into the score, and it's easy to, if you have a short amount of rehearsal time, skip over some of the very specific details because, well, we'll just play it. But if you really do hone in on details of how his duple and triple rhythms interact, then you get a great sense of just how multi-layered this piece is. There is simply so much happening in this piece. It's so easy to think of it as a gorgeous symphony with long overarching melodies, gorgeous harmonies. It's far more than that. There are so many details that Brahms worked to put into this work. And so certainly with an orchestra like the Rockford Symphony, even with four rehearsals, you can get in there and really make sure. Now, you're doing it this way because he wrote it this way, but make sure you're doing it this way because he wrote you differently. Don't try to match one another. Make sure you're playing independent of one another, and that's going to get the result that Brahms wanted. So as much as you can, just really digging into what we often let go past us.
Anyone else? Sir.
If I Google best music directing schools in the United States, I always get the same.
same three names in the same order. Number one, Northwestern. Number two, Yale. Number three, Johns Hopkins.
Oh.
So my question is, you know, our present music director emeritus, Steve Larson, went there. Other than the fact that you and Steve both went there, what makes Northwestern so preeminent? And two, coming all the way from Texas, were you satisfied with the experience?
Yes, very much so. Northwestern was the top of my list. I applied to Johns Hopkins, Peabody Conservatory, the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University, all of the top programs, Indiana University. But Northwestern was my top choice. I have to say that Northwestern was what it was up until this last June because of Victor Yampolsky, the conducting professor, who just retired this last June, and I was here in town to watch his final performances. And he had an incredible discipline. He came from Russia and learned a very Russian school of conducting, and there is no nonsense in that school of conducting. And there is no, well, try it this way, but maybe this will work, or maybe you might want to, none of that. It was this and only this. And when you're 21 years old and you are fairly green, that can either land or it can miss the mark. And I'd like to think that, apart from giving me this hair, because it was quite stressful indeed. This is when all of this happened, by the way. Check out my pre-Northwestern photos, dark brown hair. Is that there is an immense sense of expectation in that program. The school itself, you know, top teachers from around the nation, many perform in the Chicago Symphony, but also Northwestern is a great balance between the artistic and the academic. And so when you are not in your music courses, you are studying with some of the top academic leaders and researchers in the country. It's a great research school. And also just having access to a city close by with so many resources. It's having access to culture. And that's what makes a big difference.
Unfortunately, we are almost out of time, even though there's a lot more I would like to talk to you about. Any last words?
No, I know we're in a bit of a time crunch. I want to say that, of course, it's been a joy for me to be here. And to get to collaborate with people like Mark and everyone else on stage. I know you know this, but I have to say, you have an incredible orchestra. You have such a dynamite staff at the Rockford Symphony Orchestra. Board members that I have met care so much about this orchestra and give so tirelessly to its future and have been there through the rough times. I think that I don't know what the future of the symphony orchestra is. I don't know what it is, but I'm very excited about the prospect. I think that we learned a lot during the pandemic. I think that we learned that we don't know everything. Yet we're all willing to roll up our sleeves and make things happen. We learned that we want to be there for the community, for frontline workers, for people that have worked in the hospital for 24 hours. We learned that we'll find a way to perform no matter what happens. And we'll do it under the aegis, under the umbrella of the Rockford Symphony Orchestra. And so I think that you have all of the ingredients. You know this. To do incredibly wonderful things, and that I can only say thank you. And just to be here for a week is a blessing to me. So I want to thank you all. And I want to thank you for your time today. It really does mean a lot that you spend your Friday afternoons here to talk to us. So, yeah.
Eric Garcia. Well, thank you all for coming. Come to the concert tomorrow and bring three friends, okay?